Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Jesus is having an exchange with some other people of faith and some professional God talkers. And Jesus is actually getting quite a reputation about this because he handles these exchanges really well. People are inspired by it. People are entertained by it. He's really starting to draw crowds when he does this. Well, there's a teacher of the law listening in. He's a scribe. And the scribe is really impressed with Jesus and how he holds up against these other religious influencers, which is a hugely significant thing because scribes are a big deal. You consult scribes when you want to know what Moses said in the Bible and how that applies now and how it's been interpreted in different times and places, stuff like that. So a scribe is like scriptural royalty. When they walk into a room, everybody gets quiet. So we get to Mark 12, and there's this scene. It says, one of the scribes came near and heard them disputing with one another, Jesus and these other leaders. And seeing that Jesus answered them well, he asked them, which commandment is first of all? And Jesus answered, the first is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. Then the scribe said to him, you are right, teacher. You have truly said, rightly said, that he is one, and besides him there is no other. And to love him with all the heart and with all the understanding and with all the strength and to love one's neighbor as oneself, this is much more important than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. When Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. And after that, nobody dared ask Jesus any questions. So they agree. And so they get to the end and Jesus high fives the guy. He says, that's great. I love that we agree. It's good to agree with the Son of God, generally speaking. And then it says nobody asks any more questions because of all people, this is a scribe and Jesus, and they're high-fiving each other. They're agreeing. What else is there to ask? We now know everything that we need to know about what is most important. Love God with who you really are, heart, soul, mind, strength, and love others as yourself. Jonathan spoke a few weeks back about what it means to love God with all your strength, that it can be literally translated muchness, or to give God however much you have to give, which takes some of the toxic pressures off. If you haven't listened to Jonathan's message from a few weeks back, I recommend it. Generally speaking, though, this command is love God with your genuine self and love others in a way that your genuine self would like to be loved. And Jesus and this guy are completely in sync. And he tells the guy, you're not far from the kingdom of God. And everybody's stunned. This is it. I'm telling you everything that you need to know. What you said is right. I agree with you. You're not far from the kingdom of God. How we might say it today is that's not bad. That's pretty good. But here's the thing. And maybe you can hear this in your head right now as we speak. Isn't this scribe still a terrible sinner that needs to be saved, or he's going to be punished in unending flames for being a wretch? Like, isn't there a whole lot more? These might be the top two, but isn't there like 100 other things that we have to consider that means this scribe is still in bad shape? I mean, because not far from the kingdom certainly doesn't mean actually in it. I mean, if we really press Jesus's phrasing here, because the scribe might understand what's really important, but Jesus is still thinking, right? Too bad. I mean, you're really close, but you still make my father sick, you dirty sinner. Or maybe come at it this way. Isn't it terrible that Jesus forgot to say what he should have said to this guy? This not far, but definitely not even close scribe? How irresponsible of the Son of God to forget to tell him all of the things he needs to know. That, yeah, you're this close, but, you know, close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. Jesus forgot to explain some really important stuff that you and I know, that we've known since we used to go to Sunday school. Or maybe a more accurate way to come at it would be like this. Jesus has this audience of some of the most influential religious thinkers in that environment. And yet, despite what Christian theology would evolve into hundreds of years later, Jesus doesn't see fit to bring up anything about the man's terrible flaws. That, yeah, he's got some good ideas, but he still is terrible. He's instead praised. He's held up. And the gospel writer is making sure that he is properly held up for understanding in the context of so many other rules and regulations and so many other pressures. He's held up as understanding what actually matters to God. Be truly wide open with God and be truly good to others. So today I want to talk about shame. And remember as I do that I cannot do this exhaustively. One, because I don't have time, and two, because I don't know everything about it. I'm going to leave a lot out, and I'm definitely not going to get to everybody's, hey, wait a minute, that are going to pop up as I go. But I want to talk about shame in a way that I see it affecting people the most in my little corner of the planet. And even then, I'm only going to graze the surface of it in that particular lane. But nonetheless, today, I want to talk about shame, because it's shame, whether you're aware of it or not, that makes us think that we have to add terrible things to what Jesus said is enough. It's shame that insists we have to see ourselves negatively, awfully, in order to have good doctrine or to signal that we're serious about the Bible and faith. It's shame that makes us believe that we're hated until we meet the conditions of unconditional love. It's shame that makes us think so badly of ourselves that we pretend to be someone else in hopes that maybe the universe can be tricked into being glad that we exist. The idea of our shame is so stained indelibly in us that many of us can't understand even the good news unless it's put up against terrible news, the idea of our own terrible awfulness and what that terrible awfulness has earned us. Some of us cannot understand God's love and grace if our own individual wretchedness isn't true. But ask yourself, what are the implications of a Jesus who never, ever in any of the Gospels says anything about any of this? He never tells people they're born in sin, they're fundamentally flawed, they're full of shame, that they're loathsome to the perfect Creator. What should we take away from the fact that for all the sermons about us being born sinners, that God hates us until we become Christian, a specific kind of Christian, that Jesus doesn't seem to know about any of that? Because I don't know if you know this, but according to four separate gospel accounts written for the express purpose of telling us everything we need to know about Jesus, Jesus is never depicted as having any idea about us being wretches, being fundamentally flawed, shameful beings who God rightly wants to have murdered over and over for eternity. So apparently, there's no need for the shame we thought was absolutely necessary for love and grace and good news to work. Now, for those of us worried that my messaging is trying to say that no one's responsible for anything that they do, that nothing matters, that what I'm trying to say is, you know what, sin is a non-issue. First of all, I really want to say this to that accusation, which does come up every once in a while. That's childish. That's a childish way of coming at what we're talking about today. I have, for instance, three kids, and they're amazing kids. And I take some credit for that. Not for all of it. Not for most of it. But I can, my wife and I take credit for some of it, and because the reason they're amazing is that they understand responsibility and sin and love, but we never used shame. There's no shame. Remember, shame is different than guilt. It's been pointed out over and over. Guilt is, that's about having done the wrong thing. I've done wrong and felt guilty. You've done wrong and felt guilty. We have felt guilty because we were guilty of something that we did. it's concerning, actually, when people do the wrong thing and don't have a sense of guilt. Well, it's concerning, but it's also apparently one of the keys to getting elected to office. Guilt has to do with your feelings about doing the wrong thing. Shame is feeling that you are the wrong thing. Shame is generally a warped view of the self that believes you haven't just messed up, you are a mess up. And so let me move away from the theological parts of this, because we can, you know, talking about theology, it can be very theoretical. You can agree with it or disagree with it, but that's not going to help you actually identify shame playing out in your day-to-day. From a very early age, we've learned to spend mental energy concerning ourselves with what others think of us. Are we good or worthy or enough in others' eyes? But some of us formed a habit of spending so much energy on this concern that it became a worry that others would never find us as up to their standards in one way or another, that we would be isolated, rejected for our deficiencies in character or appearance or our shape or our skin color, economic status, our family reputation, our country of origin, our intelligence, hosts of other factors we had no control over. Since childhood, many of us have lived with this pervasive, simmering awareness that there's something wrong about us. Not just guilt, shame. We didn't just do wrong. We are wrong somehow. So, going all the way back to ancient Greek philosophers, which definitely had an influence on Jews and Christians both, there was guidance about this. Guidance about this feeling, this worrying sense of our deficiencies, this constant wondering whether or not people viewed us in a way that we wanted to be viewed. And so the Greek philosophers had guidance that was split into two parts, really, two main parts. One is the task of developing clarity about who I think I am. Like, what do I think of myself? And then two is separate from one. And that's, well, what do other people think or say about me? So it's, what's my opinion of myself? And then separately, what are others' opinion of myself? And the Stoic philosophers pointed out this important point. We can't ever really know or control the second thing. There's no way of knowing if someone has the wrong idea about me or wants to form a bad opinion of me or make something up about me or try to bring me down for some reason or use me as an outlet for their unprocessed brokenness or whatever. I can't know and I can't control what others will come up with regarding me, which sounds a little terrifying on a first pass. There's nothing I can do to ensure people have exactly the view of me that I want them to. They may even form the exact opposite opinion of me that I was working so hard for. But here's what the Stoics said. They said, you got to accept this. You have to incorporate this into your overall embrace of real life. But then spend your energy focused on the first part. Don't waste energy on the second thing. Accept that that's true and you can't control it. And focus your energy on the first part. What do I think of me? Apart from all the other input, apart from what other people might think of me or how they view me, this part I can control, that I can actually review with some clarity if I spend time on it. But now, in our modern era, neurology and psychotherapy have added to the conversation. And these modern contributions have helped us understand that most of us, and it might be all of us, don't realize we have a distorted view of ourselves that we've carried since we were very young. So even as we try to focus on the first thing, forget the second thing, and let's focus on the first thing, our own view of ourselves, it turns out we generally don't realize that we're doing so through a warped lens we didn't know was warped, and that warped sense of self comes from how we felt we were perceived as a kid. They're not even our opinions. Some of us were blatantly, overtly shamed by caregivers when we were kids. They blew it. Parents or somebody, some authority figure, they just blew it and blatantly shamed you, maybe over and over. They mistreated you. And you actually know a little bit of why your lens of yourself is how it's been warped. And hollow as this may sound, I'm really sorry. I know that those stories are true, and I'm really sorry. From our earliest moments, though, even if things were generally good, our little brain still got the impression in large part that we were viewed, to one degree or another, negatively. The result can be similar whether we were directly shamed or not. We were made to feel, according to our little brains, like an annoyance, an irritation. Our needs were were difficult or were a pain to a pain in our caretakers' butts. We were a complication to our caregivers' lives, to their freedom. We felt like we couldn't understand, let alone do, what was required for us to be consistently pleasing. We messed up their house and their schedule. We cost them sleep. We broke things, on and on and on. Sure, there were positive moments, probably mostly positive moments. And to look back now, you can see it as an adult, and you might want to say, well, it wasn't that big of a deal. Mom and Dad or whoever, they just got grumpy here and there, like anybody would, with a lack of sleep or the stress of being on for so many days in a row without a break. Yeah, that wasn't a big deal. That's accurate. But that's an adult giving an adult review. But for a child, a toddler, the sense of being the object of so many bad feelings sort of stuck to the walls of our developing personalities. We took it to heart, believing that their negative feelings about us were factual statements about what we are, not just what we were doing, but what we are. So the work of establishing what I think of myself, like the Stoics told us to, is actually more complicated than they understood. To turn off all the other opinions and reflectively considering what my own view of myself is, it's extremely tricky because we have for our whole lives thought we were seeing ourselves through our own eyes, but we are in very large part looking at ourselves through others' eyes. Very important others' eyes. Think of a negative feeling you have about yourself, your appearance, your ability to understand directions, your ability to play sports, your ability to accomplish certain things. Think of how there are categories for you where you don't just feel unqualified, you feel disqualified before you even try. And I will bet you the vast majority of those things aren't your own assessments. You have taken on criticisms and unfair comparisons and confused all that as statements about what you are or what you fail to be. You didn't come up with these criticisms. Generally speaking, you onboarded something from outside of you and you made it you. You have the habit of aiming what you believe to be others' criticisms at yourself, but you forgot you're doing it in your own voice. This is shame. This is how shame works. We used it on the playground. We got tangled in it with our partners. We're at its mercy at work and at church. And of course, we have it in play as we conceive of God, the ultimate authority figure, the ultimate opinion. And our lives, our emotions, our relationships, they really start to smooth out once we get a handle on this and can see how it's happening. Once we begin the process of disbelieving shameful thoughts and feelings about ourselves that we imported into ourselves back when we didn't know any better. It smooths out when we instead start walking the journey of seeing ourselves more accurately through our own eyes, becoming more and more aware of where these accusations of deficiency actually come from. As we do this, the whole game changes because we stop subtly compensating for our deficiencies because we no longer are so easily convinced that this unique deficiency in me is even real. And if it is real, that it actually matters like I thought. We stop comparing ourselves. We stop even fantasizing about doing things. And we actually start taking steps. Brilliant, effective, wonky, error-filled steps. And our fantasies start making them real. We stop projecting our terrible self-image out onto others to make ourselves temporarily feel better. Because we can accept ourselves. The thing we once thought was hopelessly and shamefully unacceptable. And so the natural, near effortless side effect of that is we start radiating kindness and acceptance of others. And let me dig into this part explicitly. Anyone, especially pastors or those most vocal about how people should believe, when they hear this kind of thing and they mock it or tear it down, this idea of self-acceptance, that they'll call it New Age, even though I've demonstrated it goes back to ancient Greece. They mock it and they have Bible quotes about it and when they do this, they almost assuredly are projecting their own sense of shame. It will seem like they're speaking in absolutes, especially how confident they can be, but it's coming from inside them, their unfinished work, their ongoing negative feelings about themselves. In my experience, most of them feel great fear about the idea of being free of all that. Because again, they can't yet understand God's love and grace and mercy if there's no sense of our being a maggot for that love and grace and mercy to be counteracting. and I used to think this way. I used to preach this way. They need the bad in order to understand the good. Like a guy that can only think his wife is beautiful if she surrounds herself with her unattractive friends. It's really superficial. Shame insists that nothing about us or our ideas is enough. And so, of course, ashamed people, ashamed men, make it so that it's God telling us we can't possibly ever be enough. That way, shame isn't some pesky negative thought. Now it's a holy one. And listen, I'm not simply trying to throw pastors or anyone else under the bus. I just want us to be aware of how shame plays out in religion when it's rooted in the idea that what you are, who you are, what you are, is a deadly, damning problem. And that problem can only be solved by being less like you and more like someone else. We have to pay attention to that because that's the same message shame has been whispering to us. Be something other than what you are. If only you were someone else, then you could be lovable. But Jesus isn't recorded as having any interest in this kind of thinking because it doesn't work. It's not healthy. And it's not just religion that does this. Even completely unreligious dudes can hear stuff like this and think, you know, they'll say, this is all bunk. You know, what we really need to do, forget all that self-acceptance stuff and use that shame to motivate yourself to improve. But here's the thing. Improving yourself doesn't heal shame. You can improve yourself. You can learn how to do new things, learn a new language, accomplish incredible achievements, have all the trophies, and still be racked with shame in a sense that you're an error of a human. And so now you're in even more pain because now you know your accomplishments and your achievements can't heal you. Now what are you going to do? That doesn't work. This is why so many of us adults secretly feel tired and done with faith, with religion. Because we were told to keep at it, persevere, keep working and moving, keep reading the Bible and listening and applying the ideas that you're hearing in sermons. And if we just had more faith, just a little more faith, more trust, stronger convictions, then our shame would finally disappear. That nagging sense that there's something wrong with us that isn't wrong with other people, apparently, it will be paved over with glorious faith and blessed assurance. And it really did seem to work for other people, but it didn't work for us. And that made us feel even more ashamed. Gosh, we can't even get grace right. We can't even get faith right. And if we ever dared admit this at church, many of us were told in one way or another that the problem was us, which is exactly how shame works. We only thought we had tried, but we hadn't tried correctly, or we didn't try enough, or we didn't try at the right church, or we didn't try with the right heart. It's our fault. That's how shame works. I really think we can hear Jesus rebuke this kind of arrangement in Matthew 23, where he says, Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on the shoulders of others, but they themselves are unwilling to lift a finger to move them." They keep prescribing, they keep assigning, refusing to see. It's not helping. It's only increasing the sense for many of us that, gosh, we're too deficient even for God. Now, I want to give you an example from my own experience of how sneaky shame can be in our lives, because I think it might help if I just go ahead and put my own stuff out there for you to benefit from, maybe. I personally have struggled with shame my whole life, and I've known this for a long time intellectually, but emotionally and on the level of how I'm motivated, how I operate at a fundamental level, it's always there, under the surface, where sometimes I can forget it. And as I've reflected on it, I've come to see that shame is not there, my shame, is not there to make me feel bad. I don't think it's evil. I actually think it's there like this unhelpful friend, this warped idea made from a positive thing. So my shame is unhelpful, but it's a lifelong attempt at protecting me from other people's bad opinions. So when it's closer to the surface, when it's easier to spot, it feels like this. It feels like, Steve, you know you can't do this. This is not your thing. You are not in your lane. Don't try. Why embarrass yourself? Or, you know, other people are really good at this. So just keep your distance from it. Let them do it. And then no one will see that this is another area of lack in you. Or a voice that says, who you are is deficient in some really significant ways. So you're going to have to prove you're good at other things. Be extra helpful. Be extra nice. Be you know extra things, have some extra experiences maybe, so that one way or another, you look better in areas that you have the ability to look better in. Compensate in other ways. And maybe some of that resonates with you. Maybe the wording is different, but maybe it resonates. But that's how it feels when it's more obvious to me now. It would sneak by me when I was much younger, but I can see that more. It's more obvious, and I try not to let it have any control over me anymore. But here's how it operates at a deeper and sneakier level, where I don't even know that it's happening, where I have let it trick me into thinking it's actually a whole other thing. And this is my most recent favorite example. I love surprising people, especially family. I love surprise gifts. And I'm not talking about surprise gifts on birthdays or something like that necessarily. I don't ever feel like I'm super great at being a gift giver. But I'm talking about doing things for people and not letting them in on it until the reveal, until the ta-da, things I'll do for my wife or plans that I've put in place, things that I want to do for the kids, things that I'm arranging that they don't know about, or for friends, putting something together for others. Whatever it is, I like to do it where right at the end, there's a reveal that they had no idea about. And for my whole life, I've not been able to understand how anybody could have anything negative to say about the experience of being surprised by a finished project or a trip or an event or whatever it is that's been completely handled, all planned out. Ta-da, surprise. Everybody loves that, right? Until very recently, very, very recently, that I realized this is in large part because of shame, the shame in me. You see, I've never been what I think is a very linear thinker. I can be very easily distracted and miss significant details. But generally speaking, I catch them on my own time. I'll catch things along the way. I'll circle back. I'll zigzag. I'll make a ton of mistakes. But I generally speaking will find those at one point, go back, fix them, maybe take longer than somebody else would. But I end up where I need to be or close enough to feel good about what I've done. But when you do life with other people, when you're on a team, you're part of a family, you're doing something with others, and those other people you consider to be very smart, linear, logical thinkers, common sense types, and you have a deep sense of shame that you've carried since childhood about those exact things, that you don't think correctly, and frankly are unintelligent in several key ways. Well, your process can be a little exposing. It can be a source of embarrassment and frustration. And so if I can keep my process private, then I can hide all the zigzags and stumbles, all those errors that I make that I think other people probably wouldn't make. And then I come out the other side with only the result, only the positive feelings. And since I did it privately, if I don't like the end result, then I'll never reveal it. I can spare us both. I often find myself still at this point resisting collaboration or resisting leaving the door open to my progress. I don't sometimes even like being asked questions about how something is going. Believing, you know, I'm just an introvert about that stuff. I'm just sort of private about that stuff. You know, trying not to make it obvious that it's actually shame. I don't want you to see how ridiculously the sausage is made at my particular sausage factory. So my deep sense of being wrong, not just doing things wrong, but I am wrong. It motivates me to try and isolate myself and my process. So a lot of what I try to do or offer people, surprise people with even, it misses the mark sometimes because it wasn't based on input. It wasn't based on collaboration. It was all done in isolation. So sometimes when the reveal doesn't go well, like I was hoping, well, I attribute that to my deficient way of being. Gosh, I can't even get surprise gifts right. And now I've multiplied my shame, which tempts me to feel angry that nothing I ever do is right, blah, 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 blah. So remember, shame always drives us into hiding. Just like in the garden, Adam and Eve, they feel shame. And the first thing they do is they make pants and they hide in the shrubs. They cover. It's a sham, like a pillow sham that covers the pillow. A sham is just shame with no E. Shame makes us sham. It's always been that way. A friend of mine just told me he has a very similar hang-up about this. He said his wife is incredibly competent, really efficient, and he loves this about her, but he can't ever achieve what she does, financially or otherwise. So after years and years of marriage, he still finds himself tempted to walk around his house thinking, what could I do? What could I fix? What could I clean or build? What could I perform so that I would be seen as equal to what she is? And on the outside, it probably looks like love. And of course, there's love in it, but it's also to a great degree his shame. This warped sense driving him to perform actions that are so often actually not about her. They're about him hiding what he thinks he's not. And for him or me or any of us that operate this way, the result is always exhaustion and bitterness and insecurity and more shame. Show me somebody yelling at their partner, "It's never good enough." And I bet I can show you someone who yells that at themselves. So as we wrap this up, there's two things I just want us to consider. There's a thousand things probably, but just two things. Loving God with our whole genuine self and loving our neighbor as our genuine self is what we're invited to do and to make a life out of. That's it. We don't believe Jesus made an error or accidentally omitted anything about what really matters. And yet, as long as we operate from shame, from a fundamental sense that we are not only capable of mistakes, and we are, but we are comprised of mistakes. We're not. As long as we operate that way, though, we can't do what Jesus invited us to do. And here's why. If shame is the operating system, then self is where all the energy goes. If we believe that we're flawed to the core, then as we move through the world, we have to cover those flaws, trying to control other people's perception of us, trying to hide, trying even to make God feel differently about us. And so what happens is we expend huge stores of our love energy on ourselves and this ongoing, often lifelong, campaign for becoming enough in others' eyes. This is a great reason right here, in and of itself, to give up believing in a God who hates us and wants us to be afraid because of how wretched we are. If Jesus is right and love of God and others is the whole point, then us being fearful, ashamed people, that's a contradiction of self-giving love because we're stuck spending all of our juice tending to our own problems, hiding, performing. When Jesus tells the scribe that he's got it, go ahead and imagine him turning to you and I saying, stop with the groveling, the self-loathing, the systems so filled with shame, the we're not worthy, abject sinner stuff. Stop it. Bring your real self, not others' opinions of you, but your real self, the one that God already sees, heart, soul, mind, and strength, and then also love others the way you want to be loved if the roles were reversed. That's it. You can put down all the other stuff and start living like this anytime you want to. No matter who you are, no matter what you think you're not, you can start today. Now, the second part I want to offer is in response to the ongoing question, well, but what do I do with this sense of deficiency that I carry inside? How do you heal? Well, we could try this. You are perfect. You are smart. You are beautiful and funny. You are just great. You have nothing in your life that you should put any effort into because you're fine just how you are. There you go. Poof. Now you don't have any shame. This doesn't work, does it? You've heard that stuff before. Maybe you've picked up a couple books that insist it. You are welcome to tell yourself affirming things. I think that a certain amount of that is really, really good. And I was late in life starting saying affirming things to myself. But if you struggle with shame, you're not likely to believe a lot of those things very deeply or for very long. And I'm not even sure that all of them are true. See, this stuff doesn't work in large part because positive statements just don't weigh as much as negative statements for ashamed people. If somebody says, cool shirt, your breath stinks, you don't walk away thinking those two things have canceled each other out. You go find gum. You'll steal gum if you have to and spend the rest of the day covering your mouth with your hand. You will not remember the shirt thing. So here's something you might find far more helpful. Even if it takes time, it challenges your sense of yourself and others, maybe even challenges some of your ideas of doctrine and faith or whatever. Learn to think of yourself as part of the entirety of the human family. And every single member of humanity is imperfect, full of capabilities and incapabilities alike. See, we forget this because You know, even a sloppy, unskilled painting looks great from across the room. But up close, every single one of us, without a single exception, are miles away from anything like flawless. Me and you, your heroes, everyone. We can all be stupid. We can all be gross. We can all miss the point here and there. We can all have mood swings. We can all be weird. We're all capable of great harm. We're all not funny or smart or charming to someone. We're all capable of lying. We're all wrong about nearly everything. We're all selfish in relation to our circumstances. Your shame is motivating you to see others with a strangely generous idealism and then to isolate yourself as uniquely flawed. But you are perfectly imperfect. Everybody is the oddball. Everybody. And instead of seeing this and saying from a place of shame, aha, that's the doctrine of inherent sinful wretchedness, we can simply accept in ourselves that, no, we're human. I'm human. I'm the one who's like this. This is my role, to be like this, to look like this. You are playing your role, to be and look like and all that. That's you. That's your role. There's no need and no value in seeing this imperfection and then finding a way to shame it. It has not worked. That has not done anything good. We can see it all and find it as instead grounds for great mercy and for love and humility. This is acceptance. And acceptance drives out, bit by bit, shame. The goal isn't to try to rate ourselves by some ideal of goodness and then feel bad about all the ways that we don't, you know, that we come up short. The goal is to stop rating ourselves at all and instead learn to accept that we're human beings made in the image of God, capable of great beauty and some ugliness. Each of us is a unique and fractured expression of the whole. And as we start to see this, we let the kindness and love towards ourself flood in and then radiate out. Whoever made you feel awful about you, they weren't right. Even if they were great people and they did it on accident, which is generally the case, they simply carried shame in themselves and in their imperfect ignorance, they projected it on you. But it's not true. And you can begin to let go of it as soon as you want. That's not instant, but you can let go of it and stop being at its mercy. And you can trade it bit by bit for the view Christ has of you and each of us, which has no warped lens. There's no shame in it, but it's total love and acceptance. And whatever our strategies have been for compensating moment to moment for what we believe is fundamentally wrong with us, however we have avoided and resisted and warred with others because we have believed that we are by nature a terrible mistake in some way, we can begin right now to rest from all of that. We can learn to recognize the impulse to feel shame and believe it, as we might feel that an impulse to do so for the rest of our lives. And we can learn to, instead of giving into it, to smile at it because we know it's a lie. And it was never true. It's a once convincing deception that we're learning not to pay heed to any more than we would see our reflection in a pond and believe that we're a fish. We see it and we know it's not what it seems. And with this growing ability to see ourselves accurately, we can begin living and maturing as fellow members of this wonderful, screwed up, beloved clown show of a species called humanity right now. So may we see ourselves rightly and soberly and lovingly, and may we deal with one another gently as others also learn to see themselves this way. And may we take joy in each of us already being able to love God with our honest selves and to love our neighbor as ourselves. Amen.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.